I was numb. I felt I was getting back at the world for injustices I had suffered. But if you sat me down and asked me which injustices I was talking about, I wouldn't have been able to name them if my life depended on it. I snatched old women's purses, just as I had seen my own mother's purse snatched when I was 8 years old, but in my mind, the two acts were not related. I had no feelings. I had smothered them. Every time they surged up, I shoved them back down inside me the way you stuff clothing in a drawer and shut it. Reefer and wine helped me to forget any pain, and as the pain and guilt increased, my problems with drugs worsened. I took pains to keep my life as a punk a secret from my mother. I stole a bunch of blank report cards from the school library rather than have Ma see my horrible grades, which were basically zero since I never showed up. It was a complicated project requiring real ingenuity and a friend named Vincent who helped out. But I made the mistake of asking my sister Kathy to fill out the ones I used for myself because I was afraid Mommy would recognize my handwriting. Instead of putting down my usual grades, I had been an A student, Kathy wrote in C grades. Mommy looked at the grades and said, "James is no C student." She picked up the phone and called the school and got the shock of her life. She could not punish me. She knew that. I was too old, too strong, and too far gone. She enrolled me in summer school and I got thrown out. My older brothers came home from college and admonished me, beating me from one end of the house to the other. I still got high and stayed out all hours. Finally, Mommy sent me to stay with my sister Jack, who had moved from Harlem to Louisville, Kentucky with her new husband. "Jack will straighten your butt out," she sniffed. I told her I doubted it. I loved Jack. She was a small, pretty, Christian black woman with freckles and brown eyes that missed nothing. She wore elaborate wigs and talked real down home with a heavy, deep accent full of "I ain'ts" and "come ons." She sometimes wrapped her head in scarves and worked as a cook and domestic, usually for white people. But beneath her domestic look was an intelligent, clairvoyant woman who understood more about me as a mixed child than I understood about myself. Jack had lived in Harlem for 10 years before moving to Kentucky. She knew more about the street than I did. Going to stay with Jack for the summer was not punishment for me. It was sweet liberty, and I stayed there 3 straight summers, always managing to get tossed from summer school in New York City just to get sent down there. Jack was too busy to keep a watchful eye on me, or so I thought. She had a young baby, worked full-time as a cook in a cafeteria, and had a husband who was a handful. The first time I came to her house, she told me, "You want to hang out? Go on out. You'll see. But if you come into my house with a gun, I'll shoot you myself." And she meant it. She let me run around, albeit reluctantly, with her husband, Big Richard, whom I worshipped. He was a tall, thin, chocolate-skinned man with a mustache who favored shades, short-sleeved shirts, shiny shoes, and shark-skin pants, and always held a lit cigarette between his teeth. Big Richard was a cool customer who ran with some rough dudes down in Louisville, but while many of his friends had been cut, stabbed, maimed, and shot, Big Richard always stayed injury-free, because his brain worked like a bilge pump, immediately sucking info out of any situation, his mind clicking behind those dark shades at all times. He could walk into a nightclub and sniff danger instantly, backing out right away. "Someone's gonna get shot in there," he'd say. And sure enough, the next day, you hear that someone got tagged. Richard worked at the Brown and Williamson tobacco plant, but all day and night before his shift started, he and I would go hang out with his boys on the corner at the Vermont liquor store, a couple of miles from Jack's house at 34th and Vermont Avenue on the city's west side. The 3 summers I spent at Vermont Liquors on the corner, which Big Richard pronounced Kona, were my true street education. The men on the corner were southern working men, plumbers, carpenters, painters, drunks, con artists, retired army lifers from nearby Fort Knox, tobacco workers from Brown and Williamson, and some just plain old hustlers. They were big, muscled men with white teeth and huge arms who wore work clothes and undershirts, painter's pants and work boots. They smoked filterless Pall Malls and Territons and drove big cars, electric 225s, Cadillacs, and long Oldsmobiles. They liked fine women, good whiskey, crap games, and the local softball league in which they fielded a team of good-natured alcoholics. They played other teams of good-natured alcoholics, and while fistfights occasionally broke out, rarely was there a gunfight afterwards. The men on the corner were honorable drinking men, with their own code of ethics. A man's word was his bond. You never insulted anyone's woman. You didn't drink from the same bottle as a man who confessed to oral sex with women. You never cuffed the dice during crap games. And if you pulled out a gun, which you shouldn't do, you better use it before it got used on you. They had names like Red, Hot Sausage, One-Armed James, and Chicken Man, an old drunk who was my favorite. Chicken Man was a small man with deep, rich, almost copper-toned skin, a wrinkled face, and laughing eyes. He wore an old fishing hat that seemed to cover his entire face and plaid pants that left about 2 inches of sock and 4 inches of ankle showing. He smelled of liquor and beer all the time, but he kept a pocket full of candy which he laid on the various kids who came by the liquor store to see him, some his kin and some not. You could see him coming from a distance, appearing out of nowhere like an angel, his silhouette seeming to rise from the ground in the shimmering heat, though he actually emerged from one of the ramshackle houses that lined the road a half a mile away. He'd stagger up 34th Street like a wandering bird lost in flight, his hands spread out at his sides like he was flying, waving at cars that honked at him, arriving at the corner at 2 p.m., drunk. He'd set up shop on the corner like it was his office, sitting in front of the liquor store on a wooden crate and drinking till he ran out of liquor money, at which time he'd stagger off, blindly drunk, laughing at some silly philosophy he'd just laid down. Chicken Man was a sweet man. He was completely incoherent when he was drunk, but when sober, he was one of the chief philosophers of the corner. He'd sit on his crate like King Tut, his arms folded, his head shaking, and he'd watch traffic pass, commenting on life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, money, liquor, don't mix corn liquor and cheap wine ever, and women. Never pork a woman on her period. Her body's given off filth. Chicken Man laughingly called white folks Mr. Charlie, or Chuck. How Mr. Charlie got his name, Chicken Man explained one day, is from when you're drunk. You call on them like this, Charlie, he feigned throwing up. But when you're real, real drunk, you call them Chuck, like this, Chuck. He feigned severe throwing up. What about Ralph, I asked, knowing full well that when a dude threw up, we called it Ralphing. At least in New York we did. Forget Ralph, he don't count. Mr. Charlie counts. Now buy me a beer. The man on the corner seemed to pay no attention to Mr. Charlie. The closest they came to him was when the police rode by, sometimes stopping to ask if anyone had seen this or that person. They were met with stony silence, or sometimes even jokes and laughter. The men did not seem to be afraid of the police, nor did they dislike them. Their lives just seemed complete without the white man. I liked that. Their world was insular, away from the real world that I was running from. They called me New York and let me sit out there all day practicing my flute and smoking all the weed I wanted. I turned 15 on the corner, but could act like I was 25, and no one cared. I could hide. No one knew me. No one knew my past, my white mother, my dead father, nothing. It was perfect. My problems seemed far, far away. One of Big Richard's good friends was a guy named Fred, who had burned half his scalp off in a fire someplace. I stole a few car batteries with Fred until somebody saw us in the driveway at night, flicked the porch light on, and took a pot shot at us. You don't need to be doing this no way, Fred said, panting for breath when we were in the clear. He wouldn't let me run with him anymore after that. Like most dudes on the corner, he looked out for me. When I protested, saying I need money, he said, "Don't worry. I'm going to get you a job in a turd factory and making all the money you want." "What's a turd factory?" I asked. "It's a factory where they make turds." He explained this to me one afternoon while he, Big Richard, and I were cruising around in his car. Big Richard was riding shotgun, chomping on his cigarette and staring out the window to keep from laughing. "I want the job," I said. "What do I do?" You sit in a big chair and the turds float down this long stream of water and you separate the big turds from the little turds. Well, how do you do that? They got a tool you use, or you can use your hand, whatever. It doesn't matter. It's good money, man. You want the job or not? I want it, man. I want the job. Take me there. I finally did get a real job pumping gas at a station about a mile from the corner. The man who ran it was named Herman, a big, burly black man with a wide chest who was as mean as the day was long. My first day on the job, the mechanic at the station, a young, light-skinned black guy, told me, "Don't cross Herman. He put two men down already." I didn't ask any questions about those two cats, just made sure I wasn't the third, because Herman was a big, mean, irritated, angry, butt-kicking dude. Every night, just before closing time, he'd hand me a bucket full of gas and a mop and say, "Mop this goddamn floor and don't smoke while you're doing it neither." Then he'd stand right outside the door and smoke and watch me mop the entire floor of the auto shop. Nobody ever robbed Herman's station while I was there, nor did any customers ever fool with him. My job was to pump gas, change tires, fix flats, and generally keep out of Herman's way, which I more or less did, but I got into a fist fight with one of his friends, a scar-faced, scratch-a-match-in-the-palm-of-his-hand homosexual who was harassing me. Who knows? Maybe it was my girly face and New York accent, but he got funky with me one afternoon and I punched him in the face a few times before he went under his car seat for a pistol and chased me around the station. The ruckus caused a big stir, and Herman fired me on the spot. I retreated to the corner, plotting revenge and seeking wisdom from my main man, Chicken Man. A sober Chicken Man had two words of advice. "Forget it," he said. "I can't forget it. I should have gotten a gun and shot him," I said. Chicken Man chuckled. "You don't know shit from Shinola," he said. "Is this how you want to end up, going to jail for him? Because that's where you'll end up, doing time and hanging on this corner when you get out. Is that what you want for yourself? Because if you do, you can have it. Go on." "I'm a smart guy," I said. "I don't have to take that kind of shit. Nobody knows how smart I really am, Chicken Man, but I'm smart." "And nobody give a damn neither," Chicken Man snapped. "Everybody on this corner is smart. You ain't no smarter than anybody here. If you so smart, why you gotta come on this corner every summer? 'Cause you're flunking school. You think if you drop out of school, somebody's gonna beg you to go back? Hell no, they won't beg your black ass to go back. What makes you so special that they'll beg you? Who are you? You ain't nobody. If you want to drop out of school and shoot people and hang on this corner all your life, go ahead. It's your life." I had never heard Chicken Man talk so severely, and what he said didn't really hit me, not right away. I said to myself, "He's just a drunk," and continued my adventures. Not long after, however, a guy named Mike, an easygoing, humorous 6'8" guy who had always encouraged me to get off the street, had an argument on the corner with his girlfriend Mustang, a fine, lithe black woman with a large black ass and a foxy wiggle. As the argument progressed, Mike began slapping Mustang around so hard I wanted to jump in, but Chicken Man stopped me. "Leave that alone, New York," he hissed. "That's between him and his woman. Don't never get between a man and his woman." Mustang left the corner in her car, burning rubber, promising to bring her new boyfriend back to kill Mike. The corner quickly emptied. There was nothing like the threat of gunfire to make everyone go home. The next day, Big Richard gave me explicit instructions to stay off the corner. But I snuck over there anyway and watched as Mike came by that afternoon, rumbling up in his big Buick playing Marvin Gaye on his 8-track player. He cut the engine and got out whistling. Totally cooled out, like it was another day at the office. He walked to the back of his car, opened the trunk, and calmly pulled out a lawn chair, a towel, and a sawed-off double-barreled shotgun with both barrels taped together. He set the lawn chair in front of the store and sat down on it. He put a bottle of J&B Scotch on the ground on one side of him, a bottle of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill wine on the other side, placed the shotgun on his lap, and put the towel over it. "I'm gonna sit here and drink and rock, and I'll wait for 'em," he said coolly. He sat there for 2 days, rocking, drinking, while the men tiptoed around him, keeping one eye on the road and one eye on Mike. Mustang's new boyfriend never showed. The next week, Mike and Mustang showed up on the corner arm in arm, kissing and hugging. That's why you don't have no arguments with no women, Chicken Man said. It don't do nothing but fool you around. But not long after, he did get into an argument with a woman. They argued in the morning, and he went off and forgot about it. And later that day, she came into the liquor store and stabbed him as he was waiting in line to buy a beer. He coughed a few times, then laid down on the floor and died.
Graduation. After my abortion, I wrote to Tata and said I didn't want to come back to Suffolk. I enrolled in Girls Commercial High School on Bergen Street in 1936. It was just down the street from Bubba's. But the schoolwork was hard, and I struggled my entire junior year, sleeping on Bubba's couch and wrestling with algebra every night. Girls High was way ahead of Suffolk High, and I never would have graduated on time. So after the school year ended, I returned to Virginia to finish high school. When I came back to Suffolk, the first thing I said to Peter was, "We can't see each other anymore. Don't come by." He said, "I've been waiting for you. I still love you." And I was swayed because I still felt deep love for him. Not long after that, I was in the store behind the counter and two young black women came in. I overheard them talking about Peter, and one of them says, "Oh, yeah, he's getting married soon." I almost fell over. Tata was standing right next to me, so I grabbed a rag and I started wiping the counter, edging close to them, eavesdropping. I was practically falling over the counter trying to hear them. "Oh, yeah," says the other. "He got such and such pregnant." She named a black girl who lived behind us in the neighborhood. I went right out and found him. The heck with who knew about us then. I was so mad I marched right down the road to his house in daylight and got him out. "Tell me the truth," I said. He confessed it. "They're making me marry her," he said. "My folks are making me." "Did you get her pregnant?" "Yeah." Oh, that messed me up. I told him I didn't want to see him anymore, and I walked back through the black neighborhood into the store and went upstairs and cried my heart out because I still loved him. I went through this entire ordeal, and here he was getting busy with somebody else. The fact that he was black and the girl he was marrying was black, well, that hurt me even more. If the world were fair, I suppose I would have married him. But there was no way that could happen in Virginia, not in 1937. I made up my mind then that I was going to leave Suffolk for good. I was 17. It was my last year of high school, and for the first time in my life, I was starting to have opinions of my own. There was no life for me there. I was planning to leave for New York. But see, I had Mama. I was her eyes and her ears in America. She couldn't speak English, and I translated for her and looked out for her because Tata didn't care for her at all. Her stomach was starting to bother her, and she was starting to have these fainting spells, you know. She'd just black out in the middle of the day. Tata couldn't have cared less. He hired a black woman to look after Mama, and that woman cared for Mama more than he did. She'd stay late and look after Mama, even if he didn't pay her. And he paid her so little as it was. He thought money he spent to take care of his wife would do, you know, substitute for the fact that he didn't love her. But a wife wants love. She was a good Jewish wife to him, but their marriage was starting to crumble because he didn't care about her. That's why I knew I was leaving home. I wasn't going to have an arranged marriage like my parents did. I'd rather die first, which I did do in a way, because I lost my mother and my sister when I left home. Well, the kids in my high school were excited and giggling about the prom and graduation and making plans, but I'd been to New York and seen the big time and didn't plan on going to either. No one asked me to the prom anyway, but Francis kept saying, "Please go to graduation, Ruth. We'll walk together on graduation day." I never told Francis about any of that business I was going through. None of the stuff about Peter and my abortion in New York. She knew my home life wasn't perfect, but Frances wasn't the type to question you. She was just a giving, kind person, so I decided to go to the graduation ceremony for her, because Frances was my best friend, and I would do anything for her. Suffolk High had this graduation ceremony where the seniors lined up in their caps and gowns outside the high school and marched onto Main Street double file to the Protestant church for a ceremony. They called it a pre-graduation ceremony or a baccalaureate or some such thing. I had to ask Tata for money for the cap and gown, and the minute he heard about me marching into a Protestant church, he said, "No, forget it. You're not marching into any Gentile church." He was dead set against it. You know, my parents were so old-fashioned, European in their ways, it wasn't funny. Like if you took a social worker into my house and he talked to my parents, it would be like talking to that wall over there. They were stuck in their ways. There was no way they could change. He was still my father, and I was still a teenager living in his house, and he could still pull off his belt and beat the mess out of me when he wanted. So what could I do? He wasn't worried about my graduation. What bothered him more was that I had no marriage prospects, and he began to take me on his business jaunts to Port Smith and Norfolk, around the stores and the wholesale supply houses, and he'd introduce me to the merchants and their sons, if they had any. It was like he was saying, "Here is my daughter on display. What do you think?" Sometimes he'd send me on jaunts by myself, driving the car and pulling the trailer, me and Dee Dee. We'd load up the trailer full of goods from the warehouses and drive through the dismal swamp around Portsmouth or Norfolk. Folks would tell us, "Watch out for the red light district in Norfolk." And we'd go around Norfolk avoiding red traffic lights. Well, I was upset with Tata about graduation, and we weren't speaking for a while, but he'd reach a point where he really needed me to help him run the store, because Sam was gone and Mama wasn't feeling well. Her stomach was starting to really bother her to the point where she'd be doubled over in pain. We'd take her to the town doctor, and he'd say this or that. He mentioned an operation of some sort, but he didn't know. He was a nasty old man, and I went to him once, and he was fresh as could be, touching me in places that were not necessary and saying obscene things, so I never went back to him. Of course, I couldn't tell anybody about it, but he looked at Mama and said he didn't know what was wrong with her. Well, Tata and I argued about the cap and gown for a long time. And at one point I got so mad, I revealed my plans to go to New York after graduation. "I'm going back to New York," I told him. "I'm leaving." He stalked out of the room cursing and swearing. A few minutes later, Mama followed him out and spoke to him. They were rarely speaking by then. And the next day he came over and gave me the money for my cap and gown. "You can participate in the march," he said, "but don't go into that church. It's forbidden." "I'm going to the ceremony," I said. "Respect your mother and me," he said. "Don't break the law of the Bible. Don't go into that Gentile church," he said. Well, my mind was made up. On graduation day, Dee Dee and I opened the store, set out the meat, stacked the fresh vegetables, and I worked behind the counter until it was time to go. Of course, my parents wouldn't go to that Gentile graduation, so I put on my cap and gown and walked the 6 blocks to Suffolk High School alone and waited for Francis in the parking lot. Francis was late getting there, which gave the other students and their parents something to stare at, to watch me standing there by myself. I was ready to turn around and run home by the time she showed up. I told her, "Francis, I'm not sure I can go into that church," and she said, "I understand, Ruth. I'll graduate by myself then, because I don't want to graduate next to anyone but you." Well, I felt I couldn't let that happen, so I said, "I can do it. Let's go." We took a picture in our cap and gowns and got in line double file and marched together. The line marched out of Suffolk High's schoolyard and onto Main Street, and slowed as it bottled up at the church doorway. As we approached the church, I started to shake and sweat. And just before we reached the church doorway, I stepped out of line. I couldn't do it. I just couldn't go inside that church. In my heart, I was still a Jew. I had done some wrong things in my life, but I was still my parents' child. I turned away, but not before Frances saw my tears. She got out of line herself, but I waved her away. "Francis, you go in," I said. "Don't miss the ceremony because of me." She went in. She had to wipe the tears from her own face, but but she got back in line and marched through the ceremony alone, and she sat through the graduation ceremony next to my empty seat. I walked home sobbing in my cap and gown and caught a Greyhound bus for New York the very next day.
Driving. One Saturday morning in 1973, a few weeks after I got back from Louisville, and just a few months after my stepfather passed away, Mommy woke me up and said, "We're going driving." She thrust my 2-year-old niece, Z, that was a name, just plain Z, into my arms, and we headed out to Daddy's car. My stepfather had kept his 68 Pontiac Catalina, gold-colored with blue interior, immaculate. Before that, he'd had a 65 Chevy Impala that he paid good money for. The car, white with red interior, was a bomb. He called it a cheese box. "I'll never buy another Chevy again," he fumed as the car, loaded with kids, sat in traffic, its engine steaming and sputtering. It seemed to break down every 5 minutes. When it did start, a key wasn't necessary. You simply turned the ignition switch with your hand and it fired. And one evening, a guy did just that as Daddy was standing by the kitchen window washing dishes. He watched in silence as the guy drove off in a cloud of blue smoke. "This must be my lucky day," he said. Mommy had never driven before, as far as I knew. She was afraid to drive. She was a certified, dyed-in-the-wool New York City transit passenger who could tell you what subway train went anywhere, which stop to get off at, and how far it was to the next one if you missed your stop and had to walk back. Depending on public transportation meant she was late for everything, for work, for open school nights, for picking us up whenever she had to. Every summer when I returned home from Fresh Air Fund camp, the yellow school buses would drop us off in Manhattan, and I'd mournfully watch 300 hugging, kissing, slobbering, happy reunions between campers and parents, while the counselors flipped coins to see who would wait with me. At which time, Mommy would finally turn the corner at 42nd Street, I could spot her bowed legs a mile away, and run up breathlessly, hugging me as the counselors looked on with looks that said, "I had no idea." But those days were gone. We needed a car. It was time for Mommy to drive. "I hate this," she said as we climbed in. "You have to tell me what to do." I was almost 16 then, and although I had no license, I knew how to drive, having spent a good deal of time driving Daddy's car when Ma wasn't around, not to mention the other cars I wasn't supposed to be driving. How she knew I knew how to drive, she mercifully chose not to discuss. But by then, I had begun to turn around. Deep inside, I knew that my old friend Chicken Man back in Louisville was right. I wasn't any smarter or any wiser or any bolder than the cats on the corner. And if I chose that life, I would end up on the corner no matter what my brains or potential. I knew I wasn't raised to drink every day, to work at a gas station, or to get killed fooling around with people like Herman and his gas station knuckleheads. That life wasn't as wild and as carefree as it looked from the outside anyway. It was ragged and cruel, and I didn't want to end up that way, stabbed to death after an argument over a bottle of wine, or shot dead by some horny dude who was trying to take my manhood. You have to choose between what the world expects of you and what you want for yourself, my sister Jack told me several times. Put yourself in God's hands, and you can't go wrong. I knew Jack was right, and when I got back to New York in the fall of 1973 for my junior year in high school, I resolved to jump back into my studies and rebuild myself. Like my own mother did in times of stress, I turned to God. I lay in bed at night praying to him to make me strong, to rid me of anger, to make me a man, and he listened, and I began to change. I didn't change right away. For one thing, I was still strung out on herb. I'd watch newscasters Roger Grimsby and a young Geraldo Rivera do grim-faced reports on Channel 7 Eyewitness News about the dangers of being hooked on marijuana, and I'd laugh. "You can't get hooked on reefer," I told my friends. "I can stop any time I want." But deep inside, I knew I was hooked, and I was secretly jealous of those from my drug circle who got themselves together and pulled out. Day after day, I found myself in some dude's house getting blasted on weed and alcohol while he stuffed towels under the doors to keep the smell in. I was also suffering occasional flashbacks from taking LSD, which I had done a lot the previous year. The flashbacks came out of nowhere. A joint or a cigarette would set them off, or nothing at all. I'd be walking down the street and suddenly find myself blasted, tripping, that acid clairvoyancy high where people seem to be made of glass and the back of your hand becomes a purple star. I'd wander around the neighborhood paranoid, avoiding everyone I knew until the high wore off. Thank God crack wasn't available then, because I would have certainly become a crack addict. As it was, every single day on the way to school, during school, and on the way home, I felt I had to get high. If I ran out of pot, I drank wine. And when I couldn't get that, my buddy Marvin and I drank NyQuil, which got you high and sleepy and slightly sick. I'd come home every night blasted, smelling like a pot house, promising myself as I put my key in the door that I wouldn't get high the next day, only to open it and find Mommy standing behind it screaming at me, "What's the matter with you? Your eyes are all red and you smell funny." I wanted to give up weed, but I couldn't. Weed was my friend. Weed kept me running from the truth, and the truth was my mother was falling apart. Looking back, I see it took about 10 years for Mommy to recover from my stepfather's death. It wasn't just that her husband was suddenly gone. It was the accumulation of a lifetime of silent suffering, some of which my siblings and I never knew about. Her past had always been a secret to us and remained so even after my stepfather died. But what she had left behind was so big, so complete, that she could never entirely leave it. The dissipation of her own Jewish family, the guilt over abandoning her mother, the separation from her sister, the sudden, tragic death of her first husband, whom she adored. While she never seemed on the verge of losing her mind, there were moments when she teetered close to the edge, lost in space. Even in my own self-absorbed funk, I was worried about her, because as my siblings and I slowly got to our emotional feet, Mommy staggered about in an emotional stupor for nearly a year. But while she weebled and wobbled and leaned, she did not fall. She responded with speed and motion. She would not stop moving. She rode her bicycle, she walked, she took long bus rides to faraway department stores and supermarkets where she'd window shop for hours and spend 50 cents. She could not grasp what to do next, but she kept moving as if her life depended on it, which in some ways it did. She ran as she had done most of her life, but this time she was running for her own sanity. She operated on automatic mode, rising each morning and chasing us off to school as if things were as they always were, but she could make no decisions. Even the simplest choice, like whether to have a touch-tone telephone or a rotary one, required enormous, painstaking deliberation. If the furnace broke down, it stayed broken, not just because she didn't have the money to fix it, but because. She had always been incredibly disorganized, but now her disorganization reached new heights. I went to gym class, opened a paper bag from home in which I'd stored my gym gear, and found her underwear inside. She'd disappear from the house for hours and come back with no explanation as to where she'd been. About a year after my stepfather died, her best friend, a wonderful black woman named Irene Johnson, passed away. And Mommy teetered at the edge again, standing over the kitchen sink washing the same pot for hours, sniffling back her tears and snapping, "Get away from me!" when we approached her. "You only have one or two good friends in life," she used to preach at us. And for her, Irene was one of those. She and Irene went back to Harlem in the 40s when Ma first came to New York. Irene understood how far she had come. Irene had helped her raise her older children and had been like a sister to her, yet she refused to go to Irene's memorial service. "I'm done with funerals," she announced, yet you could see the pain on her face as she picked up the phone to dial Irene's sister to ask about the finals of her best friend's life. "Please stay in touch," Ma said, and Irene's sister did, for years. Ma was utterly confused about all but one thing. Jesus. The young Jewish girl who at one time could not allow herself to walk into a Gentile church now couldn't do without. Her Orthodox Jewish ways had long since translated themselves into full-blown Christianity. Jesus gave Mommy hope. Jesus was Mommy's salvation. Jesus pressed her forward. Each and every Sunday, no matter how tired, depressed, or broke, she got up early, dressed in her best, and headed for church. When we kids grew too old and big for her to force us to go, she went alone, riding the F train from Queens to Brooklyn to New Brown Memorial, the church she started with my father. Church revived her, filled her up, and each Sunday she returned a little more renewed until that Saturday afternoon she announced she was going to drive my stepfather's car. She sat behind the wheel, tapping it nervously and muttering while I settled in the front seat and held Z in my arms. We didn't bother with seatbelts. She stuck the key in the ignition. The engine roared to life. "What do you do now?" she asked. "Put it in gear," I said. Oh, I know that," she said. She slammed the car in drive and pulled off in a cloud of burning rubber and smoke, swerving down the street, screaming hysterically, "Woo! Slow down, Ma," I said. She ignored me. "I don't have a license," she shrieked as the car veered from side to side. "If I get stopped, I'm going to jail." She went about four blocks, ran a stop sign without pausing, then at the next intersection whipped a wide arcing left turn, stabbing the accelerator pedal, sending the big sedan reeling down the wrong side of the street as oncoming traffic swerved to avoid us. "Watch it! What are you doing, Ma? Stop the car!" I hollered. "I need to go to the AMP! I need to go to the AMP!" she shrieked. "This is what I'm driving for, right?" We jerked along for a few blocks, no cops anywhere, and miraculously arrived at the A&P. Since she didn't know how to parallel park next to the curb, she pulled up next to a parked car, slammed on the brakes, put the car in park, smashed the parking brake with her foot, and got out, leaving the engine running. "Wait here," she said. I held Z in my arms while Mommy ran inside. When she came back out, she released the parking brake, threw the car into drive, and pulled away without looking over her shoulder. Then suddenly, for no apparent reason, she might have gotten the accelerator and the brake pedal mixed up, she stood on the brake pedal with all her might. The power brakes locked, and I was thrown toward the windshield with little Z in my arms. The baby's tiny head flew at the dashboard with a great whipping motion, missing it by a millimeter. Had she hit it, the force would have severely injured her. The car sat there, the motor humming softly while Mommy gasped for breath. "That's it," she said. "I quit." She drove home slowly, parked the car, and walked away from it like she had never seen it in her life. She never got inside it again. It sat there for months, leaves gathering around its tires again, snow accumulating on its hood, till she finally sold it. "I'll never learn to drive," she said. The irony was that Mommy knew how to drive before she was 18. She drove her father's 1936 Ford back in Suffolk, Virginia. Not only did she drive it, she drove it well enough to pull a trailer behind it full of wholesale supplies for a family's grocery store. She drove the car and trailer on paved and dirt roads between Norfolk, Suffolk, Portsmouth, Virginia Beach, and North Carolina. She could back the trailer up with the goods in it, unload it at the store, back the car into the yard, unhook the trailer, and park the car in the garage, backing it up. But she had left her past so far behind that she literally did not know how to drive. Rachel Deborah Shilsky could drive a car and pull a trailer behind it, but Ruth McBride Jordan had never touched a steering wheel before that day in 1973, and you can make book on it.
Lost in Harlem. When I came to New York after high school, I worked in my Aunt Mary's leather factory and stayed with Bubba, who had moved to the Bronx. It wasn't a good situation. I wasn't a child anymore. My mother's sisters were done with me. Aunt Mary let me work in her factory, but she cut me no slack by any means. By then, she was an obese woman with a very pretty face, and she ruled her whole roost with an iron fist, including Uncle Isaac, her husband. What a henpecked husband he was. He was a shoemaker who worked at an exclusive shoe factory at 53rd and 5th Avenue, H. Bendel's. They stitched shoes for some of the richest women in New York, movie stars like Janet Gaynor and Myrna Loy. I thought he had the most glorious job in the world, meeting movie stars, but I was scared of him. He was a balding man with a nervous twitch in his face, and he drank heavily as soon as he walked into the house. He always hid a bottle of liquor in the kitchen cabinet, and he'd take big swigs from it and lean on the counter breathing heavily. His face would turn red, and he'd become vulgar and mean. Meanwhile, Aunt Mary was having her own party with a man named Mr. Stein. He was her best friend's husband. What a scandal. That man was fine, too, honey. Yes, he was. Tall and handsome. He'd come into her factory office twice a week, and they'd close the door, smooch it up, and have wine and cheese and crackers. I knew this because I was the one Aunt Mary sent to the store for refreshments. She'd snap, "Rachel, go get me some wine and cheese and crackers." And sure enough, after a while, up jumps old Mr. Stein. He'd slip into her office so they could close the door and smooch away. After an hour or two, Aunt Mary would come out with her hair and her makeup all messed up and her face all red. Of course, I acted like I saw none of this. I was happy to get a job. Shortly after I got there, around 1939, she hired a new man who had just come to New York from North Carolina named Andrew McBride. He called himself by his middle name, Dennis. That was your father. Now that was a true man there. By that I mean he was inquisitive and funny and easygoing and secure. Dennis was an excellent leather maker and artisan type, and he quickly became Aunt Mary's best worker. Aunt Mary liked to boss all her workers around, and one day she told Dennis to pick up a huge roll of leather and take it to Manhattan by subway. The roll weighed nearly 100 pounds. Dennis said, "I'm sorry, but it's impossible for one person to carry that alone," and he refused to do it. That was one of the first times I ever saw a man, any man, stick up to Aunt Mary. She backed down. Dennis saw the callous way my aunt treated me, and he saw her love tryst with Mr. Stein, and he never said anything about how she acted with Mr. Stein, but he'd always offer a kind word to me, or just make a joke. What a sense of humor he had. The man could make a dog laugh. He'd sometimes bring me a cup of coffee or just do kind things for people. Not just for me, but for anyone. That's the kind of person he was. He was the kindest man I'd ever met to this day. And if I had any sense, I would have snatched him up right away and married him. But I was young and trying to get away from my family. And plus, I discovered Harlem. I don't know what drew me there, maybe because I lived around black folks most of my life or because I'd heard so much about it. In those days, nobody in New York City went to the Village to have fun. Harlem was the place. White and black came to Harlem to party. There weren't heavy drugs and crime like there is now. It was different. People were flowing up to Harlem in droves, from the South, from Chicago, from every place. Harlem was like magic. I take the number 2 subway train from Aunt Mary's factory and jump off at 125th Street, and the adventure would begin. There were theaters from 8th Avenue down to Lenox Avenue. One block of Harlem had more movie theaters than all of Suffolk. The Lowe's, the Alhambra, the Rialto. Then crossing over into 7th Avenue were a bunch of smaller theaters, and of course on 125th Street you had the Apollo Theater. Sometimes I'd go to the Apollo and stay all afternoon. There were 4 shows, and if you went in at 11 a.m., you could see 3 shows plus the movies. I got tired of Aunt Mary treating me so mean, so I quit her factory and I started looking for a job as an usher or a movie ticket clerk in Harlem. I always liked movies and theaters, so one afternoon I moseyed up to this movie house on 7th Avenue and asked for the manager. He came out, looked at me, and asked, "What the heck are you doing in Harlem?" "I'm looking for a job," I said. "Well, what kind of job do you want?" he asked. "A ticket clerk," I said. "What else are you looking for?" he asked. "I'm not looking for anything else," I said. "I want a job as a ticket clerk or an usher." "You have an usher job?" He got mad. "We don't do that kind of thing here," he said. "You got to go somewhere else to do that," he said. I never caught on to what he was saying. This man thought I was a prostitute, which I almost did become. I went to a few other places with similar results. Nobody would hire me. Why would a white girl hang around Harlem unless she was up to something bad? When there was so much work downtown. Impossible. And I was so naive, I just kept wandering around, not knowing I was headed for trouble, which I found soon enough. I had no luck with movie theaters, so I decided to try beauty parlors. Back in Suffolk, Tata made me take a beauty course from a woman who had a thriving beauty parlor downtown. She employed one beautician, a blonde girl who wore orange lipstick and lived out in the country and came to Suffolk every day to work. This girl taught me how to do manicures and also to work on hair, how to finger wave, shampoo, and give permanence. But this was on white people's hair. Well, I said, hair is hair. And I went into a little place off 135th and 7th Avenue and I said, I can give permanence. And the woman hired me and gave me a chair. Well, I didn't know a thing about perming black people's hair. And my first customer was a black woman and I mauled that woman's hair. Her hair looked like chopped meat when I was done. I kept telling her, you'll be ready as a radio. Ready as a radio. That was a big saying back then, ready as a radio. I told her this while I was perming and cutting her hair because when you're a hairdresser, you have to chat with the customers, make them feel good, and act like, you know, everything is toasty. Well, I didn't last the day before they threw me out. I fumbled around, and finally I said to myself, well, I can manicure good. I seen plenty of salons and barbershops with signs posted that said manicurist wanted. These were mostly men's barbershops. That didn't bother me because I had heard being a manicurist in a barbershop was easy and the tips were good. I walked up and down 7th Avenue and finally came to a place, the Hi-Hat Barbershop. It was a block from Small's Paradise on 7th Avenue and 138th Street, and there was a sign in the window that said manicurist wanted, so I went in and inquired about the job. The manager, Rocky, was a heavy, well-dressed, light-skinned man with a deep voice. He was in his 50s. He hired me immediately. He put the manicuring table in the front window, and he plopped me right there, and I worked in the window. I went home that night and told my grandmother I had a job that paid $15 per week. Bubba said, what kind of job is it? It's a good job, I told her, but I didn't tell her what kind of job it was, and neither did I tell her where it was. There are a lot of entertainers and musicians who came through there, and many times I heard them remark to the boss, Rocky, you're taking a chance having this underage white girl working here. But he didn't pay them no mind. I was 19, and that was old enough for him. He began to hang around my manicure table all the time. One day he told me he would take me to lunch, and I accepted. He had a nice car parked in front of the shop, and he was quite prosperous, so I went out with him. I didn't make too much of it. I wasn't aware that he had other plans for me. He started taking me out more and more to the Apollo and movies, and then he would drive me home to the Bronx. He had a nice car and money, so what the heck? I was impressed by that. He took me to clubs, and he was well known to folks there. Sometimes he would take me into Small's Paradise, which was frequented by musicians, entertainers, pimps, prostitutes, and he seemed to know everyone. I told him I always wanted to be a dancer, that I wanted to try for the Rockettes at Radio City. He said, I'll set it up. But I got scared, and I didn't go to the audition. I was a dumb, small-town girl, but I wasn't dumb enough to go down there and make a fool of myself. What if all the other girls danced better than me? Forget it, honey. Rocky rented me a room on 122nd Street near 7th, so I wouldn't have to make that long trip to my grandmother's house in the Bronx. He took me driving down 7th Avenue and up and down 125th Street. There were girls standing around in the street. He said, I'm going to teach you about those girls soon. Well, I knew what was happening then, but I didn't say anything. I didn't have any objection to it at first. I would stay in the little room he rented for me for a few days and then go back to Bubba's, then go back there to my little room again. Bubba was getting very suspicious now. But she was very old then. She slept a lot, and you know, she had diabetes. And I got over on her the way my grandkids get over on me now. I told her anything, you know? and after a while it got so that I couldn't see my grandmother anymore and keep doing what I was doing, hanging out in Harlem. I had to break away and not go back home to her because Bubba reminded me too much of what I was and where I came from. I needed to move into Harlem completely and make enough money to stay there and be cool and wear the fancy dresses and the clothes. So one day I asked Rocky, when do I get to make money like your other girls? I knew what I was saying. I wasn't blind, but what was love to me? What did I know about love and sex? I wanted to be swinging. But Rocky said, you're not ready to get out there yet. I'll tell you when you're ready. Well, one night I was fooling around up at Small's Paradise in one of those clubs with Rocky, and I hadn't been back to Bubba's for couple of weeks, and for some reason I started thinking about Mama and Dee Dee. I was afraid to call home because of Tata, but I knew Dennis was working for Aunt Mary, so I somehow ran him down in Harlem where he was staying. I asked him to see if he could find out how my mother and sister were doing because it was a small factory, and he could hear my aunt talking about things. He said, they've been looking for you, Ruth. How are you doing? And I told him all about my new flat and my new friend Rocky and how nice he was, and a look crossed Dennis's face that just made me go silent. I was living high off the hog, you know, just trying to bury my past and get away from my father. But when I started to tell Dennis what I was doing, I felt so ashamed because the look on his face said it all. He said, Ruth, your parents haven't done nothing to you that was so bad as to make you run around with that man. That man's a pimp. He's a pimp, and he's leading you around by the nose. And he sat there, and he kind of fumed. I mean, he wasn't angry. He just seemed disappointed. I felt so ashamed then. I got up and said, they don't have to look for me anymore. I'm going home. I gathered myself together and went straight back to Bubba's in the Bronx. She was so worried about me. But when she asked where I'd been, I didn't give her direct answers. I just told her not to answer any phone calls or give out any kind of communication about me. Rocky called, sent flowers, but I never called him back. He was persistent, and at one point came to Bubba's apartment and knocked on the door and stood in the hallway saying, come out, Ruth. I know you're home. Come on out. But I stood behind the door, and I didn't open it or say a word. He kept sending flowers and trying to get me back into his clutches. But after a while, he stopped calling, and I never saw him again.
Lost in Delaware. In June 1974, Mommy walked into the kitchen of our house in Queens and said, we're moving to Delaware. Pack up the house. She had five kids at home and seven who were away at college. Some were in graduate school, some in medical school. All had scholarships or loans and were barely making it themselves and thus could not help her financially. Our house had fallen into tremendous disrepair and Mommy couldn't keep up with it any longer. We packed up the house for weeks. I was ready to move. If we stayed in New York, it was almost certain I'd have to do an extra year of high school to finish. Plus, I kept running into my old friends who were getting into bigger and bigger trouble. I needed to see some new faces, a fresh start. My younger sisters, on the other hand, loved living in New York, had none of my problems, and didn't want to leave. Why move, they argued. We're happy here. They called a family meeting. Mommy sat down to talk it out, listened to their reasoning, pursed her lips, and nodded her head. If you feel that way, she said, we'll stay. She got up and announced breezily, we're not moving, and walked out of the room. It was as if she had pulled out a grenade, yanked the pin, dropped it on the floor, and exited. My brothers and I looked at one another in shock. By then, the house had been on the market and was being sold. There was a buyer. Contracts had been signed. Teachers had been told. Preparations had been made. We argued about it for hours. We should move, I said. Forget it, my sisters argued. We have to go, my older brothers commanded. They felt Ma couldn't afford to live in New York any longer. Ma was called in to re-enter the debate. Let me think about it again, she said. She sat down on the couch and immediately dropped off to sleep, snoring away while the rest of us argued. My mother is the only individual I know who can fall asleep instantly for 2 minutes. deep REM sleep, complete with snoring, only to be awakened instantly by certain select noises. A hurricane won't move her, but the sound of a crying baby or a falling pot will send her to her feet like a soldier at reveille. When she awoke, she wandered off saying nothing. Days passed. Finally, she announced, "We're staying." Cheers from the girls. We slowly began to unpack. The very next day, she barked, "We're moving." Cheers from the boys. We packed again. Ma went back and forth on this for weeks while the realtor pulled out his hair trying to decide if his commission was going to come through or not. The debate lasted literally up to the August morning when we rented a U-Haul truck, loaded it up with all our worldly possessions, some of us riding with the furniture in the back, and pointed it down I-95 toward Wilmington, Delaware, looking like the Beverly Hillbillies. "Why Wilmington?" we asked Ma. "Why not?" she said. "It's cheap." She had bought a small house in town for less than $12,000, which is what she could afford. We knew nothing about Delaware. Mommy had an old friend from Harlem who lived there. "You'll do fine in Delaware," Ma's friend said, but from the moment we parked our U-Haul in front of our new home, we were completely lost. We thought we'd function in Wilmington as we had in New York, catching subways and buses and living off public transportation and the groove of the city. But Wilmington had no subway, and only the very poor took the bus, which stopped running at about 9 p.m. Unlike New York, where Ma could stretch a dollar for a mile and lead her troops to the promised land of Macy's, Gimbel's, and Orbach's, entertaining them for free at museums, parades, block parties, and public concerts, Wilmington was a land of suburban shopping malls, high school marching bands, blonde prom queens, small-town gossip, and an inner city from which whites were fleeing as fast as their Ford Pintos could take them. We were shocked by the racial division of the city and surrounding county, where most of the black kids attended understaffed and underfunded city schools, while whites attended sparkling, clean suburban schools with fantastic facilities. The segregated schools came as a complete surprise to Mommy, who had not even considered that problem, and the southern vibe of the city, anything south of Canal Street in Manhattan was south to us, brought back unpleasant memories for Mommy. She hates the South. A few months after we arrived, a group of Delaware state troopers stopped a group of us on a dark highway one night after my older brother David, who was driving, made an illegal U-turn. The troopers were tall, arrogant, and unsympathetic. They surrounded the car full of black kids and white mother, shone flashlights everywhere, and made David, then a doctoral student at Columbia University, stand outside in the cold without his coat while they questioned him pointedly. They then hauled him into night court while the rest of us followed, frightened and angry. Mommy was furious that her shy, intellectual son, she was always so proud of David and would literally have carried his books to school for him if he had asked her to, was placed before a judge, who asked him to announce whether he was guilty of the traffic infraction or not. She immediately jumped into F. Lee Bailey mode. "Don't say guilty," she cried. "They'll lock you up." "Please, Ma," Davis said, trying to calm her as the judge looked on. "No, no," she shouted, "you're not guilty of nothing." Looking back now, the whole incident was only a routine stop, ticket, and trip to night court. And when I later covered cops as a reporter for the Wilmington News Journal, I saw a much better side of the Delaware State Police. But Mommy did not have that insight, and from that moment on, she hated Delaware. "We're really moving back to New York now," she said. "We haven't sold the house yet. We'll get out of that contract." My sisters loaded the northbound Amtrak train at Wilmington, carrying their possessions in shopping bags. Contingency plans were made, appointments were drawn up, promises were struck. "Y'all follow us with the truck, we'll enroll in school, talk to the principal for me, okay? See you in New York." And they were off. 2 hours later, I talked Ma out of it. "What's back in New York?" I asked her. "There's nothing back there for us. It's over. You can't afford that house." Regretfully, she agreed. The girls called up from the city, and she ordered them back home. She was spinning in crazy circles only because she was trying to survive, and movement was always her modus operandi when things got tough. She was a 54-year-old widow living off a small pension and Social Security with 5 kids still left to raise. She had never been on her own in terms of moving, checking out neighborhoods, buying houses, driving cars. It was a lot for anyone to do alone. Her job through two marriages, the first for 16 years, the second for 14, had been to mother her children, but now she had to run a family and she was learning late. She also was drained emotionally and felt tremendous guilt about moving us out of New York. She often sat at the kitchen table in the evening, brooding. What have I done? What was I thinking? Staring off into space, holding a cup of cold, untouched coffee. Prayer turned her around. That and the public school system, which forced her hand. When she saw the tattered books we brought home from school, she rose up like the mommy of old. You'll be a nothing with this kind of education, she said. She bought an old, used Toyota for $900, took a driving course, and despite the fact that the driving instructor was a dirty old man who, in her words, got fresh with his hands, got her driver's license within 2 weeks. She opened up the phone book, ran her finger down the list of private and Catholic schools, called the schools, found out which ones had scholarships, and drove me up to one. The headmaster interviewed me for 4 hours. He gave me a writing test, a geography test, then laid a bunch of math on me, which stumped me. If I hadn't missed so much school the previous 2 years, I might have smoked those tests, but I had barely passed the 11th grade and was lucky to be a senior. The man wasn't sympathetic. He said because I'd be entering his school as a senior, I might not be able to adjust. The school turned me down. I went to the all-black public Pierre S. DuPont High School with my sisters Kathy and Judy and liked it fine. The kids called me New York like folks did in Louisville, but now I kept away from the hangout crowd and dealt with my music, focusing on tenor sax and trombone, which I picked up in order to play in the marching band. The change was good for me, and I gave up weed and drinking for the discipline of music with the help of the school's outstanding music teacher, a black man named C. Lawler Rogers. Overall, the schoolwork in Delaware was 10 times easier than the work in New York, and I was selected to travel to Europe with the American Youth Jazz Band, which was organized by a very kind white music teacher from Newcastle County named Hal Schiff. The American Youth Jazz Band trip to Europe wasn't free. You had to pay for it, which I could not. My trip was paid for by a well-to-do couple from nearby Chadsford, Pennsylvania, named David H. and Ann Fox Dawson, who had donated a good part of their lives and resources to inner-city kids for many years. Mr. Dawson was a tall, trim, gray-haired man who was senior vice president at the DuPont Company. He and his wife were the band's main sponsors, giving scholarships to needy musicians. In exchange, you had to work on their estate on weekends and during the summer, so in the space of a year, I went from getting high on a street corner in Louisville to butlering parties for old money blue bloods in cheeky Chad's Ford. I combed my afro down, dressed in a suit and bow tie that Mrs. Dawson loaned me, and carried trays of hors d'oeuvres around, me and Pearl, the black woman who had done Mrs. Dawson's cooking and housework for years. Pearl lived in Wilmington like I did, and one day I pulled her aside and asked her, "Why do you work for these white folks?" She looked at me like I was crazy. She and Mrs. Dawson were quite close. She said, "You out here too, ain't you?" And that shut me up. At the Dawson Affairs, I quietly served the chuckling white folks, the president of DuPont and the governor of Delaware, among others. These people were nothing like me or my mother or anyone else in my family, but I had no anger toward them. My anger at the world had been replaced by burning ambition. I didn't want to be like them, standing around sipping wine and showing proper manners and acting happy when they weren't. I'm similar to my mother in that way, but these people had done nothing to me. I could see they were willing to help the band, and indirectly me, because I was dying to go to Europe, so I was grateful to them. My expectations of them went no farther than that. I was the clumsiest, worst party butler Mrs. Dawson ever had, and to her everlasting credit, she did not fire me right away. I wrinkled people's coats as I collected them, crushed their hats, spilled drinks, and dropped hors d'oeuvres everywhere. Mrs. Dawson was constantly saying, "James, carry the tray this way. No, this way. Now, put it over here. Now, straighten the tie. And put the towel on the arm like this. Hold the tray up, up, up. Oh, my crash!" Down went the tray. I liked Mrs. Dawson, despite the fact that I often made her cross. She was a demanding, witty, spry woman who was the first white person I ever had an ongoing dialogue with about music and literature, which she enjoyed greatly. She turned me on to classical composers and literary writers whom I had never heard of, tried to correct what she considered to be my poor speech and manners, which I did not like at all, and often made me sit with her and read poetry, the words of which later in life would suddenly pop into my memory out of nowhere, as if someone had planted them there, which she, in fact, had. James, James, Morrison, Morrison, Weatherby, George, Dupree. Took great care of his mother, though he was only 3. Catering her parties wasn't my only job. I wasn't a total house Negro, so to speak. Most of my work was in the field. The estate was a huge piece of land, acres, encompassing a horse barn, a large vegetable garden, and a pool tended by a young white caretaker named Harry. We cut grass, trimmed trees, cleaned the barn, ran a jerry tractor, and kept busy all day. Harry was a hillbilly and a smart dude who liked to hunt deer, and he kept a supply of beer and a long shotgun behind the seat of his pickup truck specifically for those purposes. I liked Harry and kept him laughing all day. He marveled at how I got out of doing all the dirty work Mrs. Dawson wanted me to do. "James, you're a lazy guy," he told me one afternoon, "and if you don't tighten up, Mrs. D will find you out." I paid him no mind, but not long afterward his prophecy came true. I had to get up at 5 a.m. to catch a bus to Mrs. Dawson's from Wilmington and was often exhausted when I got there. One hot afternoon, Mr. Dawson caught me sleeping in the strawberry patch that I was supposed to be weeding and told Mrs. Dawson about it. She got angry and fired me on the spot. "How can you fire me?" I said. "I've got to go to Europe." "I'm sending you to Europe," she said, "but you're fired anyway. You, boy, have to learn to work." Well, when she said I was going to Europe, I hugged her. I did mind her calling me boy, but I didn't mind her firing me. She had done me a favor. I kept in touch with her for many years. She helped me through college and helped me to get into graduate school as well. She didn't pay my way, but if I had an emergency, she would help. One morning, a couple of years later, when I was at Oberlin College, I went to my mailbox and found a letter from her telling me that her husband had died suddenly of cancer. Later that day, I was standing on the street with a group of black students, and one of them said, "Forget Whitey. They're all rich. They got no problems." And I said, "Yeah, man, I hear you." While inside my pocket was the folded letter holding the heartbroken words of an old white lady who had always gone out of her way to help me, and many others like me. It hurt me a little bit to stand there and lie. Sometimes it seemed like the truth was a bandy-legged soul who dashed from one side of the world to the other, and I could never find him.